So even after 20 years, it's a daunting task to follow Wendy in a presentation because she's such an eloquent speaker and she does such fabulous work that still gives me pause even after all this time. But it's also great to follow her because our work, it has many similarities, and so it's a nice segue to talk about women's issues that are in South Africa, but as you'll see, they're in South Florida as well. So I'm going to report today on the outcomes of a five-year clinical trial that was designed to, as you can see, promote health services linkages for African-American women at high risk for HIV in Miami, Florida. I don't have any disclosures to report, but I did want to acknowledge NIDA funding for this study, and I would love to acknowledge Dion in person. She's been a wonderfully supportive project officer throughout the whole life of the study. So as I mentioned, the target population for this study was African-American street-based female sex workers in Miami, Florida. So why sex workers? Well, we know from our own prior work and the prior work of many others that street-based sex workers are highly vulnerable for HIV, and that's due to a variety of factors: homelessness, victimization, drug use, sexual risk behaviors, just a myriad of factors that affect these women. And then when you combine that with other factors, social isolation, a lot of HIV-related stigma, and stigma from being a sex worker itself, so there are double stigmas attached to these women many times. Those kinds of factors all work together to not only put women at risk for HIV, but then they act as substantial barriers to them seeking out or utilizing services for HIV or other medical care that they might need. So that was the reason why we really want to work with women sex workers, and especially those that are street-based, because they tend to be even more socially isolated and have more life problems. And I don't know, those of you here, if you're familiar with South Florida, but we're one of the highest HIV prevalence and incidence areas in the U.S., consistently in the top three every year. So we thought, you know, in that context, it's really critical to work with women sex workers and to try to link them with HIV-related services. So our study was called Women Protecting Women. This is actually the second 5 years of the study. It was a competing renewal that was funded by NIDA. But we called it that because all of our clients are women, our field operation is staffed by women, and as Wendy said, really the idea of it, although it wasn't decorated as well as Wendy's field site, the idea was to create a warm, safe, welcoming space for women who typically don't have such a place anywhere else, so that they would come and that they would feel like they could talk to the staff there. So from the study perspective, we really had one primary goal, and that was to test the relative effectiveness of two different interventions. So which one would be more effective at linking women with the services they needed, but also reducing behavioral risks for HIV, so drug use, sexual partners, those kinds of things. So comparing these two arms in the study. So we used a strengths-based case management approach for both interventions. And the thing that I like so much about this model is that it's very client-centered, and it really allows the woman to, I mean, she works with her team, but it allows her to have control of what goal she wants to work on. It lets her control the direction of the sessions and the steps that need to be taken to work on these goals. So it really, I think, is empowering for the woman. And there's also a chance for the case manager to work with her to elicit information on her strengths and see how they can be applied to the current situation. So again, it was a randomized trial, so immediately after a baseline interview, women were randomly assigned to one of these two arms, and that the only difference between the two conditions is that in one condition, the woman worked with a professional case manager, but we added a peer, so a peer health worker was added to the team. So fundamentally, you know, we're testing what's the value added of the peer. The study was designed so that a woman could have up to 5 case management sessions. So immediately after baseline, her first session would be scheduled, and then over the next 60 days, she was allowed to have up to five sessions, because we were really trying to keep this kind of a brief, manageable intervention model. That was our lovely study team, interviewers, case managers, peers, and they were absolutely a fabulous group, and I never had so much fun working with a team in my professional life. So this is just a flow chart again to you know, give you a visual of the study design, randomized to the two arms. You know, they had the same potential for the same number of sessions, so the only difference then is, you know, the peer was present in the case management sessions for this group and stayed in contact with the woman over time, over the 6-month study period. And also, they would have an opportunity to, if the woman desired it, to go to appointments with her, if she wanted them physically to be with her at some of those things, they would have the opportunity to do that as well. And then we had 3- and 6-month follow-up interviews. So to be eligible for the study, they had to be between 18 and 50 years of age, African American women. And we also had criteria for, because it was NIDA funded, we did have substance use criteria 3 times or more a week for the past 30 days. And again, we had a sex trading criteria as well. And we focused exclusively on African American women for this study, because in a prior study, we had found that HIV prevalence was twice as high among African American women sex workers in Miami as opposed to other race ethnic groups. So over the life of the study, we enrolled 562 women. Just to give you a sense of some of the sample characteristics, there were an older sample, a mean age is 39. And what always strikes me is the high level of homelessness that we have. So more than half reported some homelessness in the past 3 months. So this is a very marginalized population. That's a population with high levels of competing needs, and the homelessness really, really gives you a sense of that. The HIV positive were 17.4%, and that's by self-report. So we actually think that it's likely that the prevalence is probably significantly higher than that. In a prior study where we actually conducted testing, we found 25% were HIV positive. This is a past 90-day substance use. You can just see here as a quick snapshot of the drugs that the women report using. Primarily alcohol and crack cocaine is a primary drug as well. I'm always interested to see that the misuse of prescription drugs is increasingly penetrating that population as well. When you look at the prescription sedatives and opioids, there are substantial proportions who report misusing those drugs as well. This also gives you a sense, probably the age may have done so as well, but these are women with long-standing involvement in sex work, 14 years, and substantial proportions report, you know, risk behavior. So there is a lot of unprotected sex in the past 3 months. And I should have mentioned earlier, I probably failed to, but one of the reasons why we were so focused on creating the environment that we were is because most of the women come to us with histories of abuse and victimization. So part of the reason we really wanted to develop a warm, supportive environment was to mitigate some of that and make them feel comfortable. As you can see, you know, 88% have lifetime histories of abuse, much of it starting in childhood. and it continues in their lives now. More than a third had been victimized by their clients just in the past 3 months. So when you sort of look at this spectrum of life problems that the women have and the high levels of competing needs, we thought, well, is our intervention going to make a dent? Are we going to, what is the response to our protocol going to be? What chance do we have? So we were really pleased by, you know, two positive signs that we saw fairly early on in the study was that we were able to retain the women in the intervention. So women kept coming back. More than 90% attended 4 of the 5 sessions, which was very heartening because that gave us a sense that what we were doing was really acceptable to the women, and at some level they felt good about coming to the project. And then as the study went on, I was very impressed by Wendy's follow-up rates that she presented, because I was really heartened by our follow-up rates as well. I thought, with this kind of a population who's homeless and transient and moving from place to place, or from pillar to post, as many of the women would say, to retain those high proportions at follow-up, we were really excited about that. So we had at least some positive inklings about the intervention. So what did we find? So we're going to look at some specific outcomes, but overall, the data are going to show that there are significant declines in a number of HIV risk behaviors for women who participated in the study. Substance use went down, although I don't display all of these. Women meeting criteria for substance dependence, that went down. Numbers of male sex partners also went down. What I was very pleased about is the second bullet. One of the things we really wanted to do, although, again, it's client-centered and women were in control of how the case management was directed and what goals they wanted to achieve, but from our perspective, one of the things we really wanted to do was link women with drug abuse treatment, because, you know, as long as they're continuing that part of their behavior, it'll be even more difficult to change some of the other things that we wanted to change. So we were pleased to see that 38% were linked to substance abuse services at some point during the 6 months that they participated in the study. So that included formal treatment and self-help, but those of you who are not familiar with South Florida, given the availability of treatment beds for women in the area, we thought this was not bad. It was a pretty good linkage rate, considering. So again, we're going to look at some specific outcomes from the study, but I think I just want to say one thing. The overall story that you're going to see on the following slides is that we did a lot of good work in reducing HIV risk behaviors. We made some good strides. The women really did a lot to make changes in their behavior. But what we see, and you'll see strong and significant effects for many of the outcomes, but we did not find one difference between the arms. So it didn't matter whether a woman had the peer, didn't have the peer, but they all got better. That's the story of our outcomes here. So these are days alcohol. You can see significant declines for both groups from baseline to 3 months and 6 months. And these are means, of course, so you're looking at mean days. Days of crack in the past 90, again, very similar pattern, and it couldn't be more similar in terms of the declines for the two arms. Oops, sorry. This was not significant, although it declined. There was a nice trend for unprotected sex to go down. It did not reach significance for either group, which is interesting. But when we looked at numbers of male partners in the past 3 months at these three intervals, we did see very strong, significant declines, again, for both groups. So we can't really distinguish anything, any benefit of one group over the other. So the last two data slides that I want to show are a nice follow-on to what Wendy was talking about with her women, because this was not the focus of the study. You know, women were controlling the direction of what services they needed. So it wasn't that this was a study designed to get women tested. That was not the goal. It was one goal that we thought about and were happy to try to achieve, but it was not the overarching aim of the study. But I think, of course, from a public health perspective, this is something we were really interested in seeing. Like, because we know among these women that testing was somewhat infrequent, there was a lot of undiagnosed HIV infection, we wondered if this approach could help women, you know, increase uptake of HIV testing. So these are proportions that were mean proportions that were tested, and that's in a 3-month period. So even the baseline is 3 months prior to baseline had you been tested, because we needed to look at parallel time intervals for it to make sense as an analysis. So we did see that we had some really significant increases in the proportion who reported being testing after exposure to the intervention. So we were very, very pleased to see that. And again, these were only for women who reported being HIV negative. Sorry, I keep going back for some reason. So then we looked at HIV care. So this is for the 98 women who self-reported being HIV positive. They were asked a follow-up question: are you currently receiving medical care for your HIV infection? One thing that surprised me initially at baseline was that 77% overall said they were, which I thought was quite high considering all the challenges that they faced. Certainly it's not ideal, but if you look at national studies of other populations, it's, you know, sort of right in line with other populations. So I thought, okay. Now, we don't have any data about whether the care is consistent. We know that they fall in and out of care, so it's just a one question, one shot piece of data, but it was a little bit heartening. And again, this was not something we really emphasized in the intervention, and we didn't find significant changes. But I thought it was interesting to point out that we did see increases. They weren't significant, but my gosh, it's going to be, you know, clinically meaningful for those folks who got into care. So I thought it was certainly worth mentioning. So just in conclusion, again, we did not see any benefit of one intervention over the other. Both seem to be very effective. I think the take-home message for me is that, you know, with a nice environment, a supportive intervention, even women with this sort of complex of life problems and challenges can really make great strides in changing their behavior. They can link with services, they can get into drug treatment, and they can change their lives. So, you know, a lot has been said at this meeting. Wendy mentioned it in her talk. I was at a couple of really interesting sessions yesterday on homelessness, street medicine, these kinds of things. Even at the opening session, so many speakers have talked about the role of trust in working with vulnerable populations and how important it is to establish that kind of trust with the population that you're working with. And I think that we were really able to do that in this study. I think that's one of the reasons we were able to successfully implement the intervention and keep the women coming back. I know that Wendy places a great emphasis on that in her work, and that's why she's so successful, because she really builds that trust and rapport with her folks. And I'm just so happy to see it being so broadly talked about at this meeting, because I think it's really a critical thing that we need to do when we're doing intervention services for folks. So that's really it. I'm leaving you with some comments from our women about the intervention. And, you know, they had an opportunity to write anonymous little comments on a survey, so nobody would know who they were. So they could have said, you know, negative things also. they had that chance. But this just gives you a sense of them as human beings and what the intervention meant to them in terms of
somebody treating them with respect, somebody treating them with dignity, and how that helped them. Thank you. Wendy? Thank you.
So it makes you feel curious, being for sex workers, that you have reduced the number of male partners.
Well, I think that's because I was, of course, thinking about that because that's their livelihood.
Right.
But I think for my group of women, that, as you know, it's all related to their drug habit. So, you know, a lot of them have some other sources of income. They may have some support from a family member, or they may have some sort of public benefits. But a lot of the sex work is related to, you know, getting drugs. So I think
I thought that was probably an economic factor there.
Yeah.
They dropped so many partners.
Yeah, but when they went into drug treatment, so many of them,
yeah.
I think that was the critical factor that would work toward reducing the number of partners. So that was what I was thinking too. How can that happen? But I think it was the factor of going into treatment that reduced the mean so much.
Can you model that?
I'd like to.
I was wondering if you were going to go on and test a peer-only model against, and I know that everyone's talking about cost, these look awesome. If you could replicate that with a peer model, that would be great. And then my second question is, how did you see the criminal justice system? I've read your work on criminal justice involved women coming into these women's lives and maybe messing up for lack of a better word.
Okay.
I haven't had enough coffee this morning. Negatively affecting your intervention and your linkages and everything.
Yeah, thank you. Great question. So the first question is, I would love to get additional funding to really look at a peer-only group, because I think, you know, I presented these data because they are the outcomes. But in my heart, I still have a feeling that the peer is very important in ways that perhaps I haven't measured in this analysis. I think, you know, just the retention in the study, the trust factor. Even if you're not assigned a peer who comes in and sits in your sessions, having that person or persons, you know, as part of the ambiance of the study, I think draws women in. I think it makes them feel at ease. So I know that the peer is important in ways that just are not clear from this analysis. So, of course, now people could say, well, you know, that's not evidence-based, but, you know, I still have this passion for peer workers. So what can I say? So, yes, I would like to. Very much like to do that. And now I forgot your second question.
Oh,
no. I started to ramble and I forgot your second.
The intersection of
criminal justice.
The criminal justice system and how that maybe affected your intervention.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to affect retention. That was miserable. So.
No, it did in some cases. So we would have women who got arrested. So a lot of them, as you imagine, have criminal justice histories. They've been arrested many times. Some have been in jail or prison for, you know, substantial time. But when we ask their current, what's your current legal status in our questionnaires, most were not under any kind of criminal justice supervision at the time. So they weren't on probation. They were sort of free and clear, for lack of a more precise term. So it really wasn't a major factor, but we did have a handful of women who, well, probably more than a handful, but we had a handful where it interfered. So they would be arrested, but typically it would be an overnight or 2 days, and you know, we wouldn't even know about it until they came in for their follow-up interview, and they would report it to us. But we did have a handful of women who were arrested, and they'd had to stay longer in prison so that we weren't able to keep to the timing of our intervention. They couldn't complete their case management sessions in the 60-day window that we had. So unfortunately, we didn't disenroll them, but we couldn't count them in the standard sort of model that we were that we were analyzing, if that makes sense. But fortunately, it wasn't that frequent.
Thank you.